Okay. So it's really a pleasure to be here with such a great group brought together. So I'm going to talk about something else that happens when you have a flat band, because these, as the various speakers up to now have pointed out, when you have a very weak dispersion, electrons can organize themselves in many ways that are not dominated by the kinetic energy of the system. I think because we've heard so much about the superconductivity, I'm going to try to skip over this if I can. We use the same techniques that you've heard about up to now, encapsulating graphene and boron nitride, making edge contacts. This is a photograph of the main device that I'll talk about. And it has an angle of 1.20 degrees. We were trying to get 1.17, so we were pretty close on this. And again, the angle is determined by doing transport, measuring the capacitance using Hall, and then seeing where the peaks occur. So here we're looking at, we have both a top gate and a back gate. In this case, they're not as fancy as Cori's. They're a metal top gate and a silicon back, doped silicon back gate. I should just reiterate that people are welcome to ask questions during the talk. So not that that's stopped anyone. So we can control both the density, cutting diagonal bottom left to top right, and the displacement field, the field in the vertical direction, by cutting from top left to bottom right. And it's convenient to, again, move this into units where there's displacement fields and density. And we're using Pablo's original convention of full filling as one, but I don't want to confuse people. This is charge neutrality, one electron per moiré cell, two electrons, three electrons, four electrons, or minus, or one hole, two, three, and four holes per moiré cell. And as you can see, as you saw late in Cori's talk, there is actually an asymmetry in the behavior according to displacement fields for a given density. So first of all, we see a feature at the charge neutrality point, a feature at full filling, a feature at half filling. That feature at half filling, it's pretty visible that it varies with displacement field, and it's not symmetric in displacement field. And here, though we may have as much disorder as the next person, here there's another reason for asymmetry in displacement field, which is that one of the boron nitrides, the top boron nitride, is aligned to within a degree of the graphene on that, the top graphene. So we can compare to a case where we have the boron nitride not aligned, and there we do not see asymmetry in displacement field, although it seems like the symmetry point is what we would nominally think is not zero displacement fields. So we don't have a deep understanding of why this seems to be the real zero at displacement field, even though we would guess that it was 0.2 volts per nanometer. So just to see how do we know that the boron nitride is aligned? Well, one way is just looking at this false color optical image, where you can see the graphene sheet and the top boron nitride. And if we just overlay a line on each of them and we move them on top of each other, we can see the two are within about a degree of each other. But then we can also look in transport, and here is, as a function of density, there's resistivity, the charge neutrality point, half filling, three-quarter filling, complete filling, and then there's a feature out here. And also for holes, there's a feature out there. And it's at roughly 1 1/8, but actually, it's also corresponding to a little bit less than 1 degree, about 0.8 degrees misalignment with boron nitride, and we think that's the origin of that feature. I wanted to point out something else here that fits into the same story. If you look at the resistivity at the charge neutrality point, that's a bit over 100 kiloohms. And that's an interesting number. You've been seeing these plots throughout the day, and typically those numbers are around 10 kiloohms. And in fact, if you look at monolayer graphene, typically clean monolayer graphene, the charge neutrality point resistivity is around 10 kiloohms, maybe 5 kiloohms. The theoretical maximum of it, if you don't break any symmetries, open gaps, is pi h over 4e squared, and that's 20 kiloohms, actually, reasonably precisely 20 kiloohms. So 100 kiloohms is higher than that, and it's not new to observe high resistivity in graphene. So insulating behavior at charge neutrality for graphene on boron nitride, and it transpired boron nitride that's aligned with the graphene, as was pointed out by Pablo's group. Such insulating behavior was observed in 2013 by my group and by Pablo's. We focused on the lowest temperature behavior and actually saw resistivities going up above a megohm, whereas Pablo's group pointed out that it looked like a gap was opening up that was of order room temperature. But in any case, this peak at the charge neutrality point seems rather different from what we've seen in the talks today. And I'd be open to input on that. I'm not certain that I've correctly interpreted the resistivities in the different papers, because they're not all put in absolute units. But that's perhaps another indication that indeed we're aligned with the boron nitride, and that does something. I just wanted to point out the case where the boron nitride is not aligned. You see that all these resistivities are lower. This measurement was made in a not as carefully constructed cryostats. The wiring did not have filtering on it. And when we measured again with proper filtering, all of these peaks go up substantially, except the one at the charge neutrality point, which still stays below 10 kiloohms. So this is our starting point. And so my student Aaron Sharp, who's here, said, well, you know, I'm not seeing superconductivity, so let's just try to study this device more carefully. And what he did was to measure the Hall slope, not just the Hall slope near the charge neutrality point, which is used for calibrating the capacitance, but the Hall slope at a range of densities. And you can see that when you go from at about 1/8 filling to half filling, the slope gets smaller. It also changes a little bit at filling 5/8. And then at 3/4, something dramatic happens. The Hall slope becomes very large. You might associate that with a low carrier density, but also it becomes quite nonlinear. So at 50 millitesla, it's already flattening out. And this measurement was in that same not filtered cryostat. So we decided to take this sample and take it to lower temperatures to look at this more carefully. And incidentally, in addition to the lower temperature, there was the proper filtering on the cryostat. And what did Aaron see? He saw that this Hall effect is now hysteretic with magnetic field. So with a coercive field that's on the order of 100 millitesla, we can go around this hysteresis loop and get two different values. In a cartoon picture, we might imagine that this would be the Hall resistance is positive and equal value that's negative. If you look at this, you can see it's not symmetric. We think that's because there's some mixing with the longitudinal resistivity, probably because of inhomogeneity in the sample and of whatever type. So in fact, we can see that by looking at the nominal longitudinal resistivity. That also has a small hysteresis loop. And But it's a much smaller change than the change in the Hall resistance. So so this was at basically 3/4 filling. This was at 0.76 filling, and we felt this was quite striking because we certainly didn't expect magnetism in this system. And of course, interactions come with magnetism, but it's not what we were looking for. And normally, we associate magnetism with transition metals, and this is carbon, and if you want to be generous, boron and nitrogen. And then, in addition to that, even if this system were magnetic, getting an anomalous Hall effect, normally that's associated with spin orbit coupling, which again is generally associated with very heavy atoms like bismuth. And again, we have atomic number 567. So this was pretty surprising to us. In looking at how this depends on filling density, we wanted to see, is this really present everywhere, or is it something special about 3/4?
So the features in transition seem to be reproducible. Are those real features?
So they are, and I'll show you that explicitly. They are not only real features, but yes, they are reproducible.
Yes. It's like the anisotropies out of the plane, and typically that occurs also in materials with large spin orbit coupling.
Yes. Right. Exactly.
It's also pretty strange.
Yes. It's exactly. So.
Sorry, do you know the anisotropy is out of plane? You're applying an out of plane field.
That's a good question. For this sample, we have not applied in plane field.
That's 100% random magnetization, right?
That's
when you turn off the field.
Turn off the field, then we see you can see that basically the entire signal remains. I think that what kind of magnetism, I would have guessed that if it were spin that it would be out of plane, but it could be orbital magnetism. In fact, there's probably an orbital component to the magnetism. So I guess I'd love to have a robust discussion about what's causing this, let me do a little bit of phenomenology and then try to speculate. So this anomalous Hall effect really occurs just around 3/4. So here's 3/4 filling, here's 0.8 filling. So this is just a few percent change, and the red curve is the size of this anomalous Hall signal, or more specifically, half of the difference between the anomalous Hall signal in the two directions. There's a little bit of subtlety to that I can explain. The blue curve is the Hall slope outside this low field region, and you can see that Hall slope seems to be getting larger as we approach 3/4. And larger in the opposite direction as we approach 3/4, and goes through zero at 3/4. So this looks as if we have a small gap or a semi-metal there, that we have a density of carriers that's getting small, therefore Hall is diverging, getting small on the other side until Hall is diverging, but in the middle we have charge disorder or whatever else is happening.
Force level, is it taken at the high field limit? So
it's taken in this region here, basically, yes. So I would not say that there are tiny error bars in that, but so this is, something is happening around 3/4. The Hall slope is going through zero, and the size of the anomalous Hall signal is getting big. Yes.
So this is seeing in a system which is aligned with boron nitride or not aligned with boron nitride?
This is aligned with boron nitride. So everything else, either everything or virtually everything I'll show you from here on is the aligned with boron nitride. Yes, sure.
And do you see anything at -3/4?
So we don't. As someone pointed out, maybe even you, the band structure is not necessarily the same. Disorder could play a different role, but we do see a peak in resistance at 1/4, but that is dependent on displacement field, but it's not as strong, and there's no anomalous Hall feature that we see there.
With displacement field?
So this is with displacement field about minus 0.2 volts per nanometer. Qualitatively, it looks similar, but the size of the feature changes with displacement field. Yeah.
So even if you change the sign of displacement field, it's still it's across the whole displacement field.
When you change the sign, things get a little crazy. But within like a region around this minus 0.22 volts per nanometer, it's more or less consistent.
Do you know, given the sign, whether you're kind of polarized towards or away from the line beam?
So I believe I convinced myself that it's toward, but I want to do that not in front of an audience. I want to make sure that I can multiply signs properly.
David, yes. Do you see it in one sample, or have you looked at other samples also?
So good question, Shankar. So this is one sample that we cooled down about 4 or 5 times in the dilution fridge, and another couple of times in the higher temperature cryostat.
Heated all the way up and cooled it down.
Right.
That's a different sample.
Yes, we've taken it out, we put it back in. So and every time in the dilution fridge, we see this hysteresis, and in the less careful cryostat, we see a step in the Hall resistance, sometimes a little bit of hysteresis. So, but it is n equals 1 in terms of the real samples. So we can ask, whatever this magnetism is, which presumably has some anisotropy because otherwise it wouldn't remain stable, whether it's in plane or whether it's out of plane or not, we can ask how stable is it? And so I'm going to show you something that looks a little funny. I'm claiming that for hours this magnetism is stable. Now this value of the Hall resistance that we're measuring, it happened to be near zero, but when we this is in red is the hysteresis loop, I think, before the before this weight, and then we continue on and we see that we continue to follow that. I'd love to have this curve where it happened to be at finite Hall resistance, and we'll get that next time. But it seems to be quite stable, and I'll come back to this in looking at switching behavior when we do try to excite it. So it can be pretty big. Here, if you take the difference between the two Hall resistances divided by 2, it's a bit over 10 kiloohms. So that's getting up toward h over 2e squared. This is at, again, near 3/4. This is at 2 Kelvin. So it's pretty robust. Yes?
How is RxX at 3/4 compared to 1/2?
Yes. So I think that it's substantially lower at 3/4, but I remember the values at 3/4, and in fact, I'll show them to you. I don't remember at 1/2, but maybe let's just go back for a moment because it's... maybe I'm wrong. At 1/2, it seems like it's actually lower, at least at these negative displacement fields. You see that at 1/2, at positive displacement fields, we get up to approaching 100 kiloohms, but at negative displacement fields, the 1/2 becomes small. Does that answer your question, Raphael?
Do you have the temperature dependency of the horizon?
Yes.
Does it look like it?
So I'm going to show that to you next. That was what I was about to show to you. So I planted you in the audience.
I already see it here.
Yeah. So. Yes. Yes. I put this on the archive just in advance so that you'd have this as the supplementary information for the talk. So. So if we look at the temperature dependence, Raphael asks and I deliver. Here's at close to base temperature of our dilution fridge. This is below 50 millikelvin. You can see that there's a large loop, coercive field, 70 millitesla, and there's a relatively large anomalous Hall signal. And then as we warm things up, you can see that the loop gets smaller and smaller, and in fact disappears, and the anomalous Hall signal remains even when there's no hysteresis loop for a little bit. So just to condense that into a plot of what's happening, first let's look at the coercive field. The coercive field goes down not smoothly, but monotonically with temperature, and is died by roughly 4 Kelvin. the anomalous Hall signal, in contrast, actually gets a little bit bigger as we warm up. I wonder whether there might be some pinning that makes it hard to align domains perfectly, and when we warm up, that's easier to do, but that's just a speculation. And then it plummets once we get to about 4 Kelvin and drops to zero around 5 Kelvin. So that's the temperature dependence of this feature. And I was pretty encouraged by this because, you know, 4 Kelvin is it's not room temperature, but it's but it means one doesn't need extreme measures to see these features, at least in terms of the environment.
So when the coercive field is zero, that just means it suddenly switches at near zero field.
That's right, exactly. So Pablo had asked about the resistivity. Yes.
In your device, you've got a bunch of different contacts, for example,
yes.
Right? So is this the same over all contacts?
So that's an important question. It looks qualitatively similar, but we seem to get more mixing of RxX in certain contacts compared to others.
Is the temperature dependence the same between different contacts?
So I'm not sure.
Like David's saying, you qualitatively see hysteresis that's present on roughly the same temperature scale.
That's all right. So I think we can dig into that more, more after. So we can look at what's happening to the longitudinal resistivity near 3/4, so sort of following Pablo's question in one of the directions. It's not a really stark behavior, and the resistivity is on the order of 10 kilo-ohms. While something dramatic is happening in Hall resistance, this is based on, I guess, the very largest Hall resistance case, anomalous Hall case that I showed you before, nothing very dramatic is happening in longitudinal resistance, and in particular, it's not diverging and it's not becoming zero. But I think that even though I wanted to lay out phenomenology, we have to have some inspiration for which measurements are we going to focus on, since there are a lot of tuning knobs. And so I'd like to suggest the possibility that, first of all, we've heard from Alan earlier today that, and we've seen in data repeatedly, that it seems that we are getting insulating states for every integer filling. So we have fourfold degeneracy, actually eightfold degeneracy, near eightfold degeneracy. We have the valence band and the conduction band. We're operating in the conduction band, and so it seems that there's in these sorts of systems you can have not only at 2 electrons per unit cell, but for moiré cell, but for 1 and 3 get insulating states, and so one might imagine that we're breaking symmetries, and furthermore that we may be breaking symmetries between states that are polarized in spin and or Valley quantum number.
Sorry, David, do you see an insulating state at 1/4 filling?
So no, or at least not dramatically. So we see a peak in resistance, particularly I think for one direction of the displacement field, but it's not as strong as some have seen. So here we are at 3/4 filling, and in this particular scheme of filling where we filled both valleys for spin down and one valley for spin up, then you could imagine that you would have a churn insulator in this case, a system that would be insulating in the bulk, would have a topological character, and would have edge states that propagate around it. Now, I'm not claiming that we have that cleanly by any means, because this system would have quantized Hall effect at h over e squared or h over some multiple of e squared if it had multiple edge states. I don't think that there's a detailed enough theory of this to be sure that this would be churn number -1, for example. So we should have quantized Hall effect if this were completely the case, and we should also have rho xx going to zero. So neither of those is the case, but but I'd like to explore how close we might be to that and what are the other possibilities. So first we're measuring rho, we're measuring resistivities, but we can convert those to conductivities, and we can look at how those change with temperature. So for example, here is sigma xx as a function of temperature, and sigma xx is pretty much flat until we get to close to 4 Kelvin, and then it rises substantially. And if you look at this graph, I'm sorry that it's small, but this is 2e squared over h, and this is 3e squared over h, so it's not zero. But it is pretty constant, and so maybe there could be some parasitic parallel conduction channel, and then the sigma associated with what we're interested in could be near zero there.
And that's a four-point measurement.
That's, yes. Well, that's combining two four-point measurements of rho xx and rho xy, and then inverting the matrix to get sigma xx. So, all right, these are different ways of plotting, but I mostly just wanted to comment on that part. There are different ways of plotting because you might want to ask, is this activated? Well, maybe it's activated over some very narrow range, and then there's some parallel conduction path, but I don't think we have enough to claim that. We can also look at how sigma xx varies with density, and this plot is showing sigma xx and sigma xy on a parametric plot as a function of density. We're going from low density up to high density, and you can see that along the way we flirt with a place here which would be sigma xy is minus 2 and sigma xx is 0. We don't hit it, but it seems to maybe be going toward there, and then it comes back away from there, and this is near 3/4. And just another way of looking at this is sigma xx versus density. Again, you see that sigma xx starts high at lower density. It has a minimum near 3/4, and then it comes back up again. And so, maybe this really wants to go to zero, but it's certainly we're not at that point here.
Sorry, I didn't understand the argument of parallel connection path, because the edge mode you carry should be dissipationless.
Right, absolutely. So what happens if you have edge conduction and also some bulk conduction? So if you have some percolation through the bulk, for example, this is something I was planning to come to it a little later, but I've spent the last 5 years studying magnetic topological insulators to try to look at the quantum anomalous Hall effect in that system and understand what is the residual sigma xx, because there is some. And it's typically come from some kind of bulk conduction, not from other edge modes that can go in both directions.
Does the edge mode short that out?
The two actually act in parallel. The edge mode does not fully short it out because, remember, it's just one mode. So we've made some simple finite element models of this, and you can see the effect of it, but I'll show you also what it does in practice. Well, I'll show you what we see and how we might understand it in terms of edge plus a bit of bulk.
So then this value of 2e squared over h, is this meaningful to 2, or is this just...
No, I think it's meaningful that it's of order 1, which means that it's inconvenient. It's low enough that we can see some glimpses of what may be edge conduction, or what I really think is edge conduction, but it's high enough that it's not unambiguous. And again, I'll come to this.
So if you see substantial edge conduction, you should have non-locality, right?
Yes. So I planted Alan in the audience as well. So there are two kinds of non-local measurements that people like to make in quantum Hall systems. And I'd welcome collecting more measurements that we should make. But one kind of measurement is a three-terminal measurement, driving a current between two contacts and measuring a voltage between one of those contacts, which is a ground, and another contact. So why is this measurement interesting? It's interesting because if all the conduction is edge modes, then then for one direction of the chiral modes, for one magnetization, for presumably one magnetic field that we have, you should populate the modes that are going to the left from contact 5, one of our contacts that we're measuring with, and that potential is going to make it all the way to our one of our non-local voltage contacts. But for the other, whereas the other contact is ground. So there should be a potential between the two. In fact, it should be H over E squared times the current. If we, on the other hand, have a chiral mode that goes the other way, then the grounded contact is going to propagate its modes to our other voltage contact, and you should get zero voltage. So the step in voltage when we flip the magnetization should be H over E squared, or presumably something smaller in our case. And so indeed, we see about 6 kiloohms change in this non-local resistance when we flip the magnetization. That's at 0.76 density. If we go to 0.74, it's gone. So it's in a very narrow range of density, around 3/4, and this is consistent. So another kind of non-local measurement that people like to make in quantum Hall is to drive current between two contacts and measure voltage between two other contacts. So this is interesting because this is a situation where no matter which direction the chiral modes flow, one contact will send its modes to both of our voltage contacts, and so there should be no voltage drop there. Now, if instead this were 2D conduction, just standard ohmic conduction, then the current would flow almost entirely on the right side, but there would be an exponentially small signal on the left side. And in our particular case, that should be up to about 3 ohms. So we can see what we measure here. We see that we actually get a signal of about 250 ohms, right at 3/4, at 0.76, and not at 0.74. And so you might look at this and say, well, it's supposed to be zero if it's edge transport, and it's supposed to be 2 or 3 ohms if it's diffusive transport, and it's neither of those. And I would say the most natural understanding for me of that is that there's a combination of edge transport and diffusive transport, where you're propagating your edge modes, but then you can leave the edge mode and go through the bulk and short it out. So it's a bit counterintuitive that something that should be zero and tiny, together they give something that's finite, but that's the best understanding that I have for what could give this.
David?
Yes?
As a point of comparison, have you looked at the non-local resistance at zero or fulfilling?
The non-local resistance, that's a good question. At zero and fulfilling, they're very resistive states. I'm not sure whether we have those data, but it's important. We have done it over a pretty broad range, not just at these two values. It's from sort of 0.6 to 0.8 or so, but I'll check. Yes?
Does this discriminate between like a broad bulk conduction versus like a network of edge states due to charge bubbles?
So no, I think bulk conduction is bulk conduction, and in this case, I mean, you could look at the temperature dependence of it, but as long as it's as long as the network were sufficiently fine grained, it doesn't distinguish between it. So in quantum anomalous Hall systems, in magnetic TIs, in fact, we believe that when we get a network of different domains, that indeed we get behavior a lot like this. So, great. Emmanuel, I will get back to you about the question. So, I guess early on, someone, maybe Corey, asked me whether the features were real in the hysteresis loop. And so here's a set of many, many repeated hysteresis loops, and you can see that the steps occur basically at the same places repeatedly on in both directions, and you know, maybe this is particular domain structures forming each time. These, if you change gate voltage and come back, these remain the same. I don't think that we have careful measurements of warming up above TC and coming down, coming back down. Also, you may notice this feature near zero. We don't understand it. It does occur mostly before we hit zero magnetic field, and maybe it's a demagnetization signal. But anyway.
What if you just measure in different contacts?
So, with different contacts, the details of this are different. I think that the jumps are often at the same field, but certainly I showed you one before where actually you can get a jump downward at a particular field. So, yes.
What metal are the contact electrodes?
So are those they're chrome gold? So
Eli Sandler tells me that with chrome gold electrodes, he sees big magnetic response.
So we should look at what are other good choices. I think we adopted the Columbia stacks, and then we simplified them and found that. But that's a good point. That
if there was an electrode effect, magnetism in the electrode, it wouldn't be.
No, I'm talking about some of the steps or some of
yes.
the.
Yeah.
Not the bulk of the.
No,
head, but
absolutely.
That
is important to consider, and I hadn't thought about that lately. So actually, perfect for looking over this with Corey. So this is RXX, this is RXY, and so you can see that actually there are jumps at the same fields, but they're sometimes jumps in the opposite direction. And we've measured RXY with the two pairs of contacts, and I think that there too we often get jumps at the same.
So RXX depends on the sign of the magnetic field.
So RXX has this hysteresis loop. We think that this is not because the true uniform RXX is affected in this way, but rather that we're getting some admixture of RXY because of inhomogeneity.
So if you have extracted the true RXX, it's not going to depend on the sign of the magnetic field.
I think that that's right, and maybe we could even try to do a proper anti-symmetrization of this. But in any case, you can see that the entire change is here. The biggest change is about 2 kiloohms, and here it's about 8 kiloohms or 9 kiloohms. So it's a smaller effect, but not negligible. Yes, Ashkan.
So your picture of valley polarization would predict a similar effect in an in-plane field?
So that's a great question. I'm not sure what it would predict, but I do know that we can apply the in-plane field. We haven't done that yet. You'll hear a talk from Feng Wang tomorrow, and which work that we did together on trilayer systems. There we did rotate the fields, and we can do that here. I think that'll be important. So now we've played with magnetic field, but there was something that we saw that was funny, which was we tried to increase the current that we were driving with, and we found that this feature went away. And so then we decided to apply a DC plus AC current, sweep the DC current and keep the AC current small, and here's what we found. We found that when we put on a current, we can flip the sign of this anomalous Hall signal, and we can go through a hysteresis loop with current, again, quite repeatable. You see that the switching currents are pretty similar each time, and also sometimes you get a couple of steps, and those are also similar. So that was really surprising to us. And as those of you who work on magnetic devices know, you can switch magnetization with currents, but usually that's associated either with an Oersted field, which is tiny here, or with something that involves spin orbit, and so either, well, either a spin torque effect or a spin orbit torque effect. And it's not obvious where spin orbit comes from here unless we have polarization of the orbital states. So this is pretty striking, and it's actually, if you considered this as a magnetic memory element for use at very low temperatures, we thought about using this for interfacing with quantum computers, this actually has a very conveniently low switching current, and it's quite stable. So we don't know how fast it is yet. But if we go to near the typical switching current and then wait and see how long it takes to switch and do this repeatedly, we can extract a transition rate, and it appears that it's really a Poisson process, that there's not a memory in the system, but the transition rate goes up rapidly as we go from 42.5 to 44 to 45 to 46 nanoamps. You can see that we go up by two orders of magnitude. Yes.
Have you estimated the Oersted field from the current?
So I did. I'm trying to remember it. So the current is on the order of 50 nanoamps. It's over an area that's it's a 2-micron wide strip, and I guess we should consider at a distance of about so let's imagine that it's a wire of diameter 1 micron, and at the very edge of that wire, my memory is that for something 5 times smaller than that, you would get 1 tesla per amp. So at this size, you should get 1/5 of a tesla per amp. So so this would, if we have 50 nanoamps, you should have 10 nanotesla. Yes,
I know.
Yes, yes, so, yes.
When you show the RxS and RxY, for those data, are these IV characteristics, are they linear?
They are at the range of currents that we've been driving. So so clearly.
The data are collected in the linear G.
So, what?
The data
yes, they're, yes, they're. And you can see this here that, I mean, basically, there's not much changing as we change our current. This
not with the DC current.
I understand, but it's basically the same, that we found that we were using an AC current that was too big, it was sweeping over this entire range. DC and AC. We were changing the AC current, and we were doing it in a range where it's linear. Yeah. So I'm going to show one more thing, which is just for analogies, where are we compared to the gold standard of quantum anomalous Hall effect, which is the chalcogenide-based magnetic topological insulators. I'm not going to go through the details here, but I am going to say the Hall effect in those systems has RxY of H over E squared. Our latest measurement in my group in collaboration with NIST shows 2 parts in 10 million. So it's really H over E squared very precisely. RxX, this was our older measurement where it was on the order of an ohm. We're now at a limit of 20 milliohms for RxX. So, so on the one hand, you know, the graphene system shows RxX that is 5-10 kiloohms. So that's of order H over E squared, and the quantization, well, it's not quantized at all. But if we and these were works the latest work is from 2018, and there was work from 2015. But the discovery of reasonable match to H over E squared in these systems was in 2013 by Chi-Kun Shui's group at Tsinghua University. And the year before, Joe Chikelsky and Takura measured those systems and got sort of similar numbers to what we're getting now. That is, on the order of 5-10 kiloohms for the Hall resistance, and about the same for longitudinal. And I think it's striking that I don't know of systems that haven't then proven to be topological that have this large an anomalous Hall signal or this large a ratio between anomalous Hall and longitudinal. So I'd be interested, if people know of other examples, I'd be really eager to see them. So I wanted to acknowledge that this work was led by Aaron Sharp in my group, who's here. I put the supplementary information, the manuscript, on archive just now, so you can all look at it to guide any further questions. This was in collaboration with Mark Kastner, who was my thesis advisor and has now delightfully moved to the West Coast and is spending a day a week working with my group. And many people contributed to this, both in ideas and sweat. So here's a summary for, thank you.
Thank you.
So you showed this feature beyond when you completely fill the bands.
Yes.
Which I think you attributed to filling the moiré of HBN and the graphene.
The HBN and the nearest graphene to it, yes.
Do you see those features within the range that you explored, like below that? Within this range of energies where you have these insulating states?
Do we see other features of the possible HBN-based moiré?
Yeah.
No, not that we know of. So you might expect that. So I can show you the. Our Landau fan is not the most beautiful in the world. It does have, features that we can try to pick out. So we don't have we have 2 and 4 around the charge neutrality point. Around 1/2, we seem to see 2 and 4, but only on one side. 1 and 4 around 3/4. We don't see a noticeable Landau fan around here. The resistances are just very high. So I would say nothing obvious that is associated with that feature down below.
I just wanted to comment that I think what you see is qualitatively all exactly what you'd expect to see if you have a 2D orbital ferromagnet with a weak spin orbit coupling. You should be hysteretic because basically an Ising system. And doesn't matter whether it's actually metallic or not. And you wouldn't, presumably in such a system when you go through zero field, the spin split, but that's not going to affect the transport.
Great.
And so.
Where does the spin orbit coupling?
Pardon me?
Where does the spin orbit coupling?
Well, you expect spin orbit coupling. Spin orbit coupling would play no role in this.
No. I think you said it's a weak spin orbit coupling.
I think.
Yeah, I just mean weak just means that,
you don't
need orbit. Oh,
it's kind of zero.
But, there's some. There's some spin orbit coupling.
So that would. So the parallel field would be a distinctive experiment to examine that possibility. Right?
Parallel field would not couple to 2D orbital ferromagnets.
Well, there's a displacement between the layers of dust.
Do I understand correctly,
but
there is no superconductivity near this state?
So that's correct. We did not see any superconductivity in this device.
And do you know why?
No. We know one thing that is probably different from most of the devices that have been shown, which is that one of the boron nitrides is aligned to the nearby graphene. But other than that, I don't have anything to suggest there. I can say I do want to make an advertisement now for maybe one of the breakout groups later. We could have a discussion about electromagnetic environment and filtering. So I can say in this cryostat, it's the same cryostat that we measured with Feng Wang and his group and his samples, and there we saw signals of superconductivity. So I think it's not impossible to at these sorts of critical currents. But
yeah, for the kinetic behavior, did you change the rate at which you move the magnetic field? I mean, which is the time of how this rate relate to the time scale of relaxation of the system?
So it's a good question. So the question was was how does the sweeping rate, sorry, how does the sweeping rate in this history, sorry, this is not magnetic field. So I think that, so Aaron, do you want to comment? I think that it's slow compared to the flipping, the relaxation rate, but.
Yeah, so we are basically, this superconducting magnet can only sweep at a maximal rate of a millitesla per second. And we're doing often much slower than that, so. Because you have to include measurement time and things like that, so.
Okay, and with this, I think we'll see you tomorrow morning.
Thanks again.